You're tuned into The Wire, 1 hour of current affairs and analysis starting now.
Tēnā koutou katoa, ko Harry Willis, tōku nua, nō mai haere mai ki te wire mō tēnei rā. Kia ora and welcome to the Thursday Wire. A whō rapere, roa te kaumarima o Kotatia, Thursday the 25th of January. It's Harry, your host here. I'm joined today by Ben and Lachlan. How are you guys today?
Good.
How are you, Harry?
I'm good. It's my last wire.
It's very sad.
As host.
Yes.
Before I hand over the reins to you, Lachlan.
To me. And Ben will find
you. Are you excited for next week?
I am a bit nervous, but I'm sure it'll all be great.
Well, don't admit that in front of the listeners, that you're nervous.
I'm human.
No, it'll be all good. In the meantime, today we've got a pretty cool show. I'm going to be talking to Professor Jane Kelsey from the University of Auckland Law Department on Labour and TPP changes. Lachlan is speaking with Treaty Negotiation Minister Andrew Little about payments made to iwi in December last year. He also introduces our Worry Wire Week of our topic of education by discussing the merits of a BA with Massey's Richard Shaw. And finally, Ben has this day in history talking the Egyptian uprising in 2011, which was now 7 years ago.
Good God.
Time flies. He aha o whakaro. If you have any thoughts to share throughout the show, we'd love to hear from you. Tuku pātui mai. Send through a text to 53955. Or why am I? You can call the studio to chat with us on 309-3879. Tuku to pota ki te pai te hou. Do not forget to vote in our Twitter polls. Our Twitter handle is 95BFM News. What are our polls today?
Two polls today. We've got, do you think the Bachelor of Arts degree is a worthwhile degree? It's got 69 votes, so nice. Has the government won significant enough concessions to justify the support for the comprehensive and progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership, formerly the TPPA? And that's also got a number of votes, so get voting on those at 95BFM News, or text in, or call.
We would love to hear from you during the next hour. But yes, let's get going.
Irirangi Pō, Radio Bosom.
The Wire.
So the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, TPPA, is reportedly a done deal again. The rebranded Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement on Trans-Pacific Partnership is due to be signed in Chile on the 8th of March. Labour and New Zealand First are confident in changes that have taken place in the partnership, and they've spent most of part of this morning defending their decision to flip from their pre-election stance and sign. Meanwhile, James Shaw released a statement yesterday that the Greens still will not sign and they're not confident in any changes. I chatted today with TPP critic Professor Jane Kelsey from the University of Auckland Law School to unpack what changes are in the agreement and just how hard our government is pushing for demands. So we're talking TPP. So the remaining 11 governments in the TPP have concluded the revised TPPA, which is now the Comprehensive and Progressive TPP. You're arguing that this is not a progressive deal at all. You're predicting that this rebrand is a bit of a sham. The government's ready to sign on the 8th of March. I was wondering if we could sort of start off, you could tell me a little bit about how the agreement has been changed. What revisions have actually taken place here?
A recent assessment of the original deal showed that about 22 of over 1,000 provisions have been suspended, not removed, from the agreement.
Mm-hmm.
That hardly makes it progressive.
Yes. What's the difference here between the suspension versus removed? I mean, these revisions being dormant, can they then come back?
I've described it as Tim Grosser, when he was justifying the original deal when National was in power, he said we had to swallow a few rats to get the final deal. Well, those rats are in hibernation. They have not been exterminated. They will be woken up like little Cinderellas if and when the US decides to re-engage with the agreement. And the notion put out by our Prime Minister that, oh, no, but there's no guarantee that they all will come back into play. The US would have to get consent from us all that would happen, is fantasy land, because if the US did decide to re-engage with this agreement, the US Congress would have to approve the terms, and not only would they demand the existing agreement and revival of all of the existing terms, but they will demand more because the reason why they couldn't get it through the Congress under Obama was that it didn't go far enough for the US Congress.
Hmm.
So we cannot expect that any of the suspended items, which include some quite important ones, for the pharmaceutical companies, for example, to be able to demand monopoly profits for longer on the really expensive new generation medicines, extended terms for copyright that give the music industry, the Sonys and the Disneys, longer protection for their entertainment products. Some of the additional costs of that were going to be estimated at around 55 million a year to New Zealand. That is suspended.
When David Parker says that New Zealand have secured their demands, their bottom line non-negotiable demands, is this security the suspensions? Some of these suspensions?
In part it is, but it's weasel words. For example, the Protecting Pharmac, or protecting Pharmac as an entity, they even said that had been satisfied, whilst the rules on intellectual property and longer-term protections to make medicines more expensive were still in there.
Mm.
It was just that the process of Pharmac, in theory, remained in place. So the five conditions from the Labour caucus are weasel words.
Hmm.
Similarly, the Treaty of Waitangi exception, they said that it's protected, and the Waitangi Tribunal said so. Well, actually, the Waitangi Tribunal said it's likely to provide a reasonable level of protection in the areas that we've looked at, but we have real concerns about some areas, and you should go back and consult with Māori about how to provide stronger protection. Well, they haven't.
So when Ardern says that Labour have been pushing hard for the issues that are important, what do you say? Is this the case?
Well, Labour went to the first meeting after the election and they were handed a poison chalice. They were told that the deal had been negotiated and concluded and you couldn't reopen anything. And so they basically accepted that and tried to negotiate side agreements.
So was that trying to take a more similar stance as Canada did with these little side agreements?
Well, it was a similar approach to seeking side agreements, but when we understand, and it's still all secret, we know there was already a side letter with Australia, so that wasn't a Labour achievement. That was already there, and that's been in a number of previous agreements.
Hmm.
And they are kind of hinting that one or two other countries may also have agreed, but we don't know who they are. They could be Brunei and Malaysia, Peru, who are hardly the big investors that we might be concerned about. But basically, when others said no, they kind of shrugged their shoulders and said, oh, okay, we tried. Whereas Canada said, no, we're going to walk away unless you actually give us some protections. Now, I'm sure that people in Canada are going to say those protections aren't nearly good enough, but our government didn't even try to play hardball. They basically were told that they couldn't have it and said, oh, okay then.
So Ardern has insisted at Ratana that the clauses involving the investor-state dispute settlement have been improved and that there is now a suspension of them for investor screening. Is this the case?
There was already in the original agreement, there was already a protection for New Zealand and Australia's screening decisions, although the wording of that is kind of vague. What additional things were agreed to, not just for New Zealand, but for all the countries, was that a side right for investors when they had a contract with the government, for example, a public-private partnership toll road, if that contract didn't say how it had to be enforced, they could use the investor state enforcement process under the TPPA. That has been removed. But enforcement of the rights of investors in the TPPA itself remains intact. Mm-hmm. That foreign investment vetting exception was in the original one, and as I said, the wording around it is somewhat vague and uncertain.
So how could Labor have potentially changed their stance on these negotiations? How could they still turn their stance around?
Well, they could grow a backbone. There's no signs that they're going to do so, and there's no signs that Winston Peters is going to try to hold their feet to the fire either.
James Shaw
is going to jump into the fire with them. James Shaw and the Greens have been the only consistent party, and it's clear that the combination of New Zealand First, Labour and National would see this through the House. I mean, what's ironic is that National is now complaining about the secrecy of the process because it can't see the final deal because it's supposedly going to remain secret until after it's been signed. And again, this is the hypocrisy of Labour and New Zealand First, who railed against the secrecy of the negotiations, and now are complicit in preventing people from seeing what's been agreed to.
Around, you know, up to 8 or 10,000.
Shit.
The Wire.
Two iwi who settled treaty breaches with the Crown in the 1990s have received a combined $370 million in further payment due to clauses in their agreements. Waikato Tainui and Naitahu were paid the money in December last year due to relativity clauses that meant they get a proportion of future settlements over the $1 billion fiscal envelope set in the 1990s. I spoke with Treaty Negotiations Minister Andrew Little about the payments. These further payments of $190 million to Waikato Tainui and $180 million to Naitahu are due to relativity clauses in their settlements made in the 90s. How do these clauses work?
What they said was, I guess to go back a step, you have to see these clauses in the context of the public debate that was happening at the time. The government of the day said they wanted to limit the total value of treaty settlements to $1 billion, what they then referred to as the fiscal envelope. I think a lot of people at the time were sceptical that the government could keep it to that sort of cap because they had, you know, at that stage over 100 iwi to negotiate with and had to negotiate with them in good faith. And it is not negotiating in good faith to put an arbitrary limit on the total value of all the settlements you're dealing with. In a sense, the way I characterise it is Ngaitahu and Waikato Tainui basically called the government's bluff and said, okay, well, if you are going to limit it to just $1 billion across all settlements, our settlement is this much, and we want that proportion, or our proportion of total treaty settlements, to remain the same regardless, so that if you do go over the $1 billion cap, the proportion of our settlement as a proportion of the total value of settlements remains the same, and that's therefore what has happened.
And I believe the we've reached $2 billion now?
$2.2
billion.
Value of settlements.
So
that's just the financial side of it. I mean, there's land that is returned and there's non-monetary sort of compensatory things as well.
So is there a possibility of future payments or is this it?
Oh, no, there will be future payments because we still haven't completed all the treaty settlements that are still lined up to go. And, of course, we have one very large one left to go, which is Ngāpuhi.
And, I mean, why is it so important that iwi get this money? How will it help?
Well, I mean, they get it because that's what they negotiated. But you see what they do with it, and both Ngaitahu and Waikato Tainui have been very successful in the investments that they've made, not just financial investments making a return, but housing for their people, health services for their people, research and policy, you might say, for their people that's going to help advance the members of those iwi. So it is building the Māori economy. I think what's important from the Crown's point of view long term is that when the Crown is discharging its responsibility that it has to every citizen regardless, which is their economic and physical security, the Crown actually struggles in many instances to be effective, and certainly in a lot of welfare sort of programs. So the opportunity to sit down with well-resourced iwi now and say, okay, we have these intractable social problems that might be employment, that might be health issues and addiction issues and so on. How can we work together, knowing that we as the Crown bear a lot of responsibility, but you as iwi have a lot of contacts, connections, structures, frameworks within which you operate, the least of which is a connection with your people. How can we work together to fix some of these intractable problems? That's the real value of getting the claims settlement process done and getting us focused on the future.
And do you disagree with those who criticise this as too much money? I mean, especially considering it's only a tiny fraction of the value of the land taken under treaty breaches before taken into less tangible loss, such as culture and language.
Yeah, if you have a look at the claims, and one of the ways or the aspects of every claim that is settled is a record is made of the harm done from colonisation and the actions of our forebears as Pākehā, the European settlers. And look, it is absolutely tragic. You read some of the stories, and it isn't. Look, the removal of land is one thing, and that is wrenching enough. But when you look at the suppression of language, the breach of human rights, Māori sent all over the country to deliberately separate them from their rohe, from their people. At one point, actually, no amount of money is going to compensate that sort of stuff. So these are settlements of claims that really are more symbolic than anything. And it is about trying to, or at least starting the process of restoring Māori to an economic and social position that they were in and would have continued to be in had the breaches of the treaty not happened. So it might look like lots of money now. Ask people in 50, 100 years' time, then, you know, people will take a different perspective. And this is just the whole process of coming to terms with an ugly side of our history that far too long we wanted to overlook and forget. We are now coming to terms with it, but this is the price we pay.
When they were drafting the clauses in the 90s, do you think these were simply just to entice iwi to settle? Did they kind of realise how much they would be paying?
I think if you think that the right for iwi to claim for treaty breaches going back to 1840 only arose in the mid-1980s. It was the fourth Labor government that changed the Waitangi Tribunal Act to allow claims going right back to 1840. From 1975, the claims could only go back to 1975. So that was the big deal.